to HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Here comes the food show.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families grow.
Welcome to the food show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel.
And I'm Peter Schoaf.
The show today comes to you in three parts. First, we're going to hear about food in Eastern Oregon. We have an interview with June Colony, a food and farming maven from Lostine, Oregon, who talks about food self-sufficiency and the process of saving a rural grocery store. In the middle of the show, we have an interview with Sander Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and most recently The Art of Fermentation, who was in Portland for the Fermentation Festival this last fall. We'll conclude the show with a live interview with cheese impresario Barry Lynn. You might want to have a pen and paper at hand during that interview. We'll be talking about pairing cheese and beverages, and there will most likely be some good ideas for your holiday parties. Before we get to that, I want to pass it over to Peter for some news updates.
All right. So last month, we spoke briefly about Christine Anderson, a dairy farmer who was suing the government because they prohibited her from advertising prices for raw milk. The ban's been in place for decades, and Christine challenged it as a violation of our First Amendment right to free speech. The sale of raw milk is permitted under Oregon law and in 29 other states at this time. However, on Monday, the American Academy of Pediatrics spoke out against raw milk. I read the abstract of the report, which states, and I quote, "The benefits of these natural factors have not been clearly demonstrated in evidence-based studies and therefore do not outweigh the risks of raw milk consumption." The American Academy of Pediatrics claims this on the basis of microbiotic evidence showing the presence of several pathogens, including E. coli and Salmonella, in raw milk. Another study published in Emerging Infectious Diseases tracked Minnesota residents who drank raw milk over the past 10 years and found that 17% of drinkers got sick after ingestion. The AAP warns that pregnant women and children should be wary of the dangers associated with raw milk and endorses a national ban on its sale. In other news, things are changing for processed foods. There was an article in the Boston Globe this morning which said that Pepsi, Starbucks, and Kraft were replacing their artificial dyes with naturally derived ones. When I picked up the article, it said that ingredients were disappearing from ingredients list. To be honest, I was expecting it to be about looser FDA regulations, but I was pleasantly surprised to find that companies are actually making changes to their products. For a while, processed foods have gotten a lot of flack about their colors. Remember back in the 90s when there was a rumor about yellow 5 causing infertility among black males? But in the past, these urban legends wouldn't get much attention, especially from the corporations. Word-of-mouth advertising has always been really powerful, so I bet their market shares even went up as somebody tried to buy Mountain Dew. Anyway, now that we have the internet, people are getting heard, and it's kind of like having a big suggestion box that the national chain has access to. Starbucks was using a red dye extracted from a beetle, but after getting a lot of comments from their customers, they decided to stop doing that. So, back to you, Chris.
Yeah, it's exciting to hear that actually positive changes are being made by big corporations. So we're going to get to now the interview with June Colony. June Colony is an inspiring farmer and business owner who lives and works out in Eastern Oregon. She was recently a part of a campaign to save a small general store in Lostine, which is in the Wallawas. She tells us about that process as well as food security and self-sufficiency in Eastern Oregon. The interview was recorded by phone here at KBOO. And here is that interview with June Colony.
I would just have a lot of food and I gave it away. That led to my purchasing a small store in Lostine called June's Local Market, where I sold produce, and I sold other people's produce, and we had kind of an informal farmer's market. Then I wrote a grant, a USDA grant application, to put together a real farmer's market, and promoted, my idea was the limiting factor for feeding this population, Lostien population is about 600 to 700 that is around a town of about 200, is that we had to have equipment to haul the food, to get it out of the field. We had to have cooler trucks to bring food into us from lower elevations, the peaches and the nectarines that we couldn't grow here. We had to have a walk-in cooler to store the equipment, and we had to have signage and tables and all this so that we'd have farmers markets. So 2 years ago is when the grant came together, and I was awarded a bunch of money. We bought a truck with a drop-in cooler. We bought a walk-in cooler equipment and had it built at the farm, at my farm. And then we started a farmer's market, not only in Lostien at June's local market, but also in Wallowa, a big farmer's market down there, a population of about 700. As part of bringing in food, I posed to M. Crone Company that we'd just go ahead and start providing the Lostien store with produce on a regular basis, since over at June's local market, produce only came 1 or 2 days a week. If we had it at Crow's store, it would be available for everybody. So there's a small group of people in the Lostien area that farm vegetables. Most people farm cattle or hay or sheep. And so this small group of people are now learning to structure themselves using this equipment and trying to coordinate our production so that somebody that has soil that's good for cabbage will grow cabbage. Somebody that has soil good for potatoes will grow potatoes. That sort of cooperation.
So you mentioned the M. Crow and Company General Store. I'm curious. The Edible Portland article talks a lot about that store and the struggle to keep it open. Could you give a little bit of a background on that?
Funny enough, when I moved to Lostien in 1973, the landlords of the two-story house that I moved into were the Crows, and they owned Ethel and Warner. They owned the Crow Mercantile, M. Crow and Company General Store, and so I hung out in the store all the time and was just kind of part of the group. So as years went by, it was evident that the next generation of Ethel and Warner's kids were not going to inherit the store. They weren't going to take on the store. So you had all three of Ethel and Warner's children took turns managing that store, either the spouse or the son of Ethel and Warner. And eventually, Doug, who was owner, this is the last manager of the store out of the family, felt that he just couldn't keep this going anymore. There wasn't any future in it if his child wasn't going to go into it. It needed to have a lot of energy. It needed a new direction. There's competition from Walmart, even up here. There's competition from Safeway. There's competition. And it was just one of those things where it was just barely holding on in the grocery department. But it also had hardware and plumbing, and it had boots, and it had clothing. So it was a general store. So when it looked like, and because I was kind of close to the Crow family over the years, it looked like he was going to close it, I sent out a bunch of postcards to everyone within, I just went to the post office and said, how many do you deliver to around Lostien? And I sent out a card to everyone, inviting them to the South Fork Grange Hall here in Lostien to come and talk about whether or not there was anything we could do to save the Crow store, to keep it going. And that was a very dramatic meeting. And Doug Crow didn't realize how loved his store and his family were and how important the store was to the community. So he agreed to keep it open longer. People started to shop there more. Our community center, which is an extension of the Lostien Presbyterian Church, we opened up a little corner of the Crow store for 2 years where we served soup. And the money that we made by serving soup was then turned around and paid to Doug as a quote rental of the corner. And that was about $600 a month, and that paid his electric bill in the winter, which was pretty high. So there was a concerted effort in the community to just give Doug enough time to see if he could find a buyer that would continue with the store so that we wouldn't lose the store.
And he was, and you were successful in that endeavor, correct?
We were successful in that endeavor. Praise God, we were successful. It was amazing. Not only were we successful, but we hit the jackpot because Tyler Hayes is from the Hayes family from up in Joseph, and they also came, they were here as pioneer stock, and he's a successful designer of furniture and kind of an inventor of so many things. And he remembered coming into Crow Store when he was a boy and that experience, and he loves old buildings, and he loves the simpleness of the store. And so he bought the store, and it's so exciting to see the things that are going on there, and the future of the store is just, you know, it's amazing to me. It couldn't turn out better.
Can you tell the story behind the Red Hat Society taking over the store?
Well, it's a simple story, really. As we were making soup at the corner, the soup nook is what we called it. We converted a dog food shelf and an upholstery business in town made a cushion, and another neighbor made tables out of the floorboards out of the back of my store I'd torn up, and so we instantly had this soup nook with the blessings of the health department, because it was a church-affiliated beneficent society that was making the soup and selling it by donation. So we're busily doing that when the Red Hat Society representative comes in and asks if I would serve them soup, because I do make a heck of a good soup. So they all came. We put chairs and tables out throughout the store. Some people were eating soup over by the mashed potato, instant mashed potatoes, and some were eating them by the freezers, and some were back by the cook stove, and some were up at the front tables. And I just made a lot of soup, and we have homemade rolls and a dessert that goes with it. So that was a lot of fun. And they're going to come back and do it again. We're now serving soup over at the Grange Hall. And so I get to do it again this year with them.
It sounds like quite a scene.
It was quite a scene. It was a lot of fun.
So I can tell in your voice you're excited about the future of food in Lostien. It sounds like there was this moment where it looked like it could get dark, but things are on the up and up. I just want you to kind of comment on what you think of it for the future of local food in Lostien.
Well, I believe that we're fortunate in our area that there was no lapse in the skill set of how to grow food for yourself, or how to can food, or how to store food in root cellars or freezers, or how to dry it. There was a wealth of knowledge because we're a pioneer community that was settled fairly late, and there are great grandchildren here that families settled and had to go from scratch on how to survive up here. So it is a culture of self-sufficiency. And even the children now in the FFA in Wallowa are eager to emulate what we're doing, to imitate what their own grandparents did. And being in, because there is a culture that's coming from the outside, like Edible Portland, Echo Trust, the Food Hub, all these things that are saying to the communities in the greater Oregon and actually all around the world that local food's important. Well, for us up here, we've been doing this for generations, and I felt lucky that I brought my generational connection to food with me because I fit in up here. So most of the older farmers, the older people in the community, they have gardens. They don't see it's kind of any big thing that you've got 100 jars of tomatoes. I sell by the case when it's canning season to people that are putting up food. I think that the direction that I would like to see this community go, and actually a suggestion for all of these communities around Oregon, is to not get too big. I think that in our community where we don't have a lot of people, if somebody needs a head of cabbage late at night, sometimes I'll get a call. Do you know where there's a head of cabbage? You know, and I make a few calls, I can find the head of cabbage. Even right now I could do that. And I think if you keep it small scale, then you're forming a tight community that really can't be broken. Even politically we can argue, but if we feed each other, then we're committed to each other. And Lostien has kept hold of its traditions because it's not a commercial town, it's not a tourist town, it's an agricultural town. And the people that walk in the Crow's Door from the local community are coming in from a farm or a ranch, and they come in two or three times a day if it's haying season to get a pop or something. So I'd like to see this reconnection back to the memory of feeding yourself spring to life all around the country. And I kind of think it is.
Yeah, it's really exciting and inspiring to hear. I mean, in so many places, that information has been lost. That self-reliance has been lost. It feels like, so, you know, in the past 5 years, I've started a farm with a friend, and we had to learn it, all that information. We kind of had to read books and whatnot, because it's hard to get that information. And so it's exciting to hear a place where that information, it never went away, where people kind of hung on to it.
But there was a whole group of people that have come in, like I did in 1973, only who has come in later. I was able to get a grant from Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education, SARE, in 2006, and I offered a class of year-round greenhouse gardening. So when it's, even in temperatures right now where it's been below zero, in a well-designed crop greenhouse, there would still be crops standing out there that we could harvest. So I put out announcements and went to the fair and had a sign-up sheet, and I thought I'd get about 12 people. I got 50. I had to cut it off at 50. I had two 100-foot by 20-foot greenhouses. They were both full, and we had a year-long education. And from that, I was able to help my students get greenhouses out of Oregon Valley Greenhouse in Aurora. And there's hundreds and hundreds of feet of greenhouse up here because of that educational class. I would like to think that everybody knows how to garden, but they don't. Even our history of gardening up here, a lot of the great-grandkids decided they didn't want to learn to garden. Now that it's in, they're remembering and they want to go back. But the next step for me here on the farm is I'm very excited about offering internships and to get as many people as I can trained on this property. It's fully irrigated, and, you know, it's pretty easy to be here.
Well, and I think there's plenty of people who are interested in learning those skills, learning that, you know, how to be a farmer, and it's people like you who are going to make it so that the next generation can actually farm successfully.
Oh, absolutely. I wish I could have been there to help you guys.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. I think that would have been lovely. So last question. I know you're extremely involved in your community. How do you stay afloat when you have so much going on?
Well, I think part of it comes from the fact that my parents were, or at least my dad was self-employed. And when you're an entrepreneur and when you're raised as an entrepreneur, there's no downtime. Like the last couple nights, I had tarps spread out in the living room, and I was sorting through my dried onions and trying to get them, get the good ones out and the ones that could save and the ones had to dry. You know, I had 300 pounds of onions, and I just work. I work all the time because it's a pleasure. And I'm organized, and I have a lot more dreams that I don't do. So for me to just do what I do, and it's complicated. I have a farm. I have sheep. I'm an active member of the church. I have my own store. I support the Grange as a secretary. I mean, there's a million things. But I don't think that I'm overworked. I just do. This is life. You got to live it.
Yeah, it's really inspiring to hear you talk. You just do, and that's good.
Uh-huh.
June, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, this has been a pure pleasure, Chris.
Yeah, pleasure for me too.
Thanks for the opportunity to share the story.
You can find an article about the M. Crow & Company General Store featuring June Colony in the winter issue of Edible Portland, which was just released.
Now we'll take a break with Raffi's The Corner Grocery Store, and when we come back, we'll have an interview with Sandor Katz.
You know what? There was once a very weird store. Very strange store that stood on the corner. And all kinds of things happened in it. There was cheese, walking on its knees in the store. There was cheese, walking on its knees in the corner grocery store. Well, there were plums, twiddling their thumbs in the store. There were plums, twiddling their thumbs in the corner grocery store. My eyes are dim, I cannot see. I have not brought my specs with me. I have not brought my specs with me. Oh, it sounds like a choir in here. There was corn, blowing on a horn in the store, singing. There was corn, blowing on a horn in the corner grocery store. There were beans, trying on some jeans in the store. There were beans, trying on some jeans in the corner grocery store. Let's hear that choir. My eyes are dim, I cannot see. I have not brought my specs with me. I have not brought my specs with me. There were flies, baking apple pies in the store. There were flies, baking apple pies in the corner grocery store. There were rats, big as baseball bats in the store. There were rats, big as baseball bats in the corner grocery store. Once again, my eyes are dim, I cannot see. I have not brought my specs with me. I have not brought my specs with me. And there was more, just inside the door. In the store, there was more, just inside the door. In the corner grocery store.
You're listening to the KBOO Food Show here. I can't help it. I have a soft spot for Raffi in my heart, so hope you enjoyed that song. So we have now an interview recorded with Sandor Katz. Sandor Katz, a fermentation revivalist, was in Portland this last October for the Portland Fermentation Festival. We were able to get him and sit down with him for the Underground Airwaves project. So he told a story about tempeh, which was really fascinating. I wish, honestly, that was a video story because he at one point made these big swooping motions. Now, we're not going to play that story now. We'll tell you at the end of the interview where you can find it. But we are going to listen to a little interview with him about the kind of the process of him becoming a fermentation revivalist, of writing Wild Fermentation and his most recent book, The Art of Fermentation. In the interview, you're going to hear another voice, a friend of mine, Lola Milholland, who works for Edible Portland and EcoTrust. So here is the interview with Sandor Katz on The Food Show.
My name is Sandor Katz, and I describe myself as a fermentation revivalist, and I have written books and teach people about the simplicity of fermentation.
So what was your first memory of eating a fermented food?
Well, I mean, certainly in my first memory, I didn't know the word fermentation, and I wasn't thinking about it as a fermented food. But I mean, you know, one of the important foods that was like a backdrop to my whole childhood was sour pickles, fermented pickles, sometimes known as kosher dill pickles, that are produced by fermentation rather than by pouring hot vinegar over them. And I just always was crazy about pickles. And when I started exploring, I grew up in New York City. When I started exploring the city myself, that was always like a cheap snack I could get with a little bit of pocket change. And I just always loved pickles.
There's that flavor, the like sweet and salty flavor that it has, that's like addictive. It got you early.
Oh yeah, totally.
How did you decide, or I don't know if it was in your decision, but to kind of lead the charge as a fermentation revivalist?
I mean, well, really, what I mean, how I got interested in practicing fermentation was that 20 years ago in 1993, I moved from New York City to a community in rural Tennessee and got involved in keeping a garden. And the first season that I was gardening, lo and behold, turns out all of the cabbages are ready at the same time in a garden, which hadn't really ever occurred to me. I hadn't thought about it. And so, when suddenly there was this row of cabbages, and what am I going to do with them all? I've always, in addition to sour pickles, I've always loved sauerkraut, and I just was like, I'm going to learn how to make sauerkraut. And I like literally, looked in The Joy of Cooking and found out how to make sauerkraut, and I made some sauerkraut, and I loved it, and I just started to get a little bit obsessed with sauerkraut and experimenting with different kinds of fermented vegetables. And then I started playing around with yogurt making and a little bit of cheese making and country wines, and I just kind of developed an obsession with all things fermented, and spent the rest of the 90s experimenting with all kinds of ferments. And then I got invited to teach a sauerkraut making workshop. These people at this other community in Tennessee that I was friendly with were hosting a food Skillshare gathering, and they invited me to teach a sauerkraut making workshop because I already had gotten a little reputation among people I knew for being the kraut guy. So I did that, and I mean, that was a really memorable experience for me because, I had no fear learning about sauerkraut, but I learned that like a lot of people project their fear of bacteria and food poisoning, onto a process as simple as sauerkraut. So, I had a really fun time kind of, dispelling that, that idea and demystifying sauerkraut for people. And then I started getting invited every year to do that. And then in 2001, I spent the summer at my friend's place in Maine, and so I was missing this annual event, and I wasn't quite as jet set then as I have become, so it didn't occur to me that I should just go for a long weekend to this event that I was feeling sad about missing. And instead, I spent most of a month writing down my fermentation recipes into a little booklet that I self-published. I made 100 copies of it, and that was also called Wild Fermentation. That was Wild Fermentation, a Do-It-Yourself Guide to Cultural Manipulation. And as soon as I wrote that, I realized that this would be a great thing to write a book about. And I started thinking about how I would expand it into a book. I started doing some research because I wanted to contextualize the process more broadly. And I was able to find a publisher. And so then I wrote Wild Fermentation, and then then I started getting invited to teach in lots of different kinds of places. So that's the story of how I found my calling.
Sure. Yeah, the charge was given to you. Or yeah. Did you see it? Was there like this vacuum you saw that you were like, you know what, that needs to get filled?
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, when I realized this would be a great thing to write a book about, it was, you know, because there was, I mean, you know, there is a lot of information out there in the world about fermentation. It's just there aren't that many, you know, books that have, you know, brought them together in one place. So, you know, as I was researching, I mean, there was really no shortage of information at all. It's just, it's all in more specialized sources. So, you know, great. There's all these books about beer and wine making. There's all these books about baking with sourdough. There's books about cheese making. You know, there's, you know, there were a few other books that I was aware of that were about fermentation more broadly. Bill Mollison's book, which was published, you know, I think in the early 90s, I had a copy of, and that was very helpful to me. I kept seeing reference to, and eventually I found a university library with a copy of Keith Steinkraus's book, which is, you know, really, I'd say, the most comprehensive book in the English language about fermentation. It's called the Handbook of Indigenous Fermented Foods, but you know, that's like a you know, like a scientific academic tome that, you know, costs, you know, $250 or something. So but no, I mean, I really just I just fell into it, you know, one step at a time. You know, at first it was just like a practical response to what was coming out of the garden. You know, then it was like sharing my enthusiasm with people, you know, right around me. Then, you know, because I was missing that one year, I was like, well, I better put this down on paper and send it down there. And then, you know, it was only when I began writing about it. You know, I think as a young person, I had always, you know, had the idea that it would be great to be a writer. But like most, you know, young people who want to be writers, I had no idea what to write about. So, you know, suddenly here was something compelling to write about.
I'm curious a little bit more about your obsession with fermented foods. Like, what is it that unites, you know, you're talking about some people have obsessions with sourdough, or not obsessions, but they write about that, or they talk about one thing. But you have managed to kind of look at it in this broad swath of kind of living bacteria that are and you know, fungi that are bringing flavor out.
Well, I mean, I think that you know, it's the strong flavors that really unite, you know, all the different products of fermentation. And you know, if you walk into a gourmet food store anywhere and like look around and think about the nature of the foods that were, you know, calling gourmet foods, they're almost all products of fermentation. You know, fermentation creates these strong flavors, and you know, foods that are, you know, widely disparate are products of microbial processes. I mean, you know, think you know, salami, coffee, chocolate, vanilla, cured meats, you know, really condiments are something I love to talk to people about, because, you know, condiments either are directly fermented, as in, you know, fish sauce, the mother of all condiments, or soy sauce, you know, or like in our, you know, contemporary American condiments, they use vinegar, a product of fermentation, as their stabilizer. So, and really like almost all condiments, you know, all around the world, you know, at least use vinegar as a stabilizer. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's really like the strong flavors, you know, and the fact that they are, you know, microbially produced. And I mean, I find the, you know, the idea of like relating to these invisible life forces and seeing how dramatically they can change things, you know, really exciting and compelling. And, you know, for me, that's really what unites, you know, all the different realms of fermentation is, you know, I mean, there's some overlap in terms of the type of organisms, but really it's the sort of like, you know, magic or alchemy of, you know, engaging with these invisible life forces. And I think that was sort of like an aspect of it that really drew me in.
It almost sounds like fermentation is a spiritual practice.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's you know, a part of it. And you know, I think if you look around the world at you know, surviving practices of indigenous people, you actually see a huge amount of, you know, ritual and ceremony organized around fermentation. I mean, it's been recognized as a mystical process by, you know, sort of disparate traditions around the world. And you know, even in you know, some of the what we call the major world religions, you know, basically the ones that don't condemn, you know, alcohol, you know, consider it a sacrament. And, you know, it's very, very, very powerful stuff. And, you know, it's easy to imagine that for, you know, people, you know, before there was like a scientific explanation to it and we had microscopes and could actually sort of see these organisms and understand that they're, you know, sort of reproducing and metabolizing nutrients, you know, it's a very sort of, you know, mystical transformation. You know, what's going on in there? You know, we don't really know. It's some kind of a magic. So yeah, I do think it's spiritual. And I also think in terms of, you know, people's, you know, interest in it. I mean, I would say that, you know, with food in general and the sort of, you know, craving for more connection to our food, I mean, there's definitely practical aspects to it. There are, you know, nutritional aspects to it. There are economic aspects to it. But I also, you know, believe and observe that at some level, it's a real sort of, you know, spiritual longing, you know, that sort of not having that connection to the earth has left people feeling, you know, severed. And, you know, the fact that, you know, so many people, you know, are sort of feeling this, you know, pull to become more connected to their food and the sources of their food, you know, at one level, it really is a spiritual searching or it's, you know, filling a, you know, a spiritual void.
Do you have any cultures that you have maintained from the beginning that have been with you all along, or others that have been with you quite a long time?
Not really. I mean, I would say that, you know, I have been, you know, I have been best at the wild fermentation at, you know, ferments which are based on the organisms that are spontaneously found on the food, which, you know, you just start it with the food. And, you know, now I have a yogurt culture that I've kept going, you know, just for like probably 4 years. I have a sourdough that I've kept going for probably 10 years, but definitely not from the beginning. I mean, I've lived in communal living environments with chaotic kitchens. I do a lot of traveling, like all the, you know, all the SCOBYs, the, you know, kombucha and kefir and all the, you know, sort of cultures that generate these sort of macro physical forms require, you know, regular feeding. And, you know, if when you travel as much as I do, it's really hard to keep them going. It's like keeping a dog when you travel all the time. You know, they just need a certain amount of attention. So no, at this point, I mean, I'm not even really trying to keep SCOBYs going. I don't have like kefir or kombucha regularly going. I use them in teaching, so I have, you know, I have friends who maintain these things, so you know, I always have, you know, access to you know, using them for demonstration purposes, but I'm not even trying. I mean, for a couple of years, I was actually like paying a friend of mine to like take care of kefir, and you know, it was really just became very costly. You know, I was paying for milk and paying for his time, and I don't know. I just realized I didn't need to really keep him going all the time.
Sure. So you published Wild Fermentations. That was 10 years ago now. I'm curious, in that time, I don't know if you've discovered new processes, new foods. What has anything happened recently that's kept you kind of excited about fermented foods?
Well, I mean, first let me just say, I mean, I always feel excited about fermented foods, and you know, they don't have to be you know, novel for me to you know, be excited about them. But I would say, you know, two things. I mean, one is that you know, I have been very, you know, lucky in that I've been, you know, getting invited to different parts of the world to talk about fermentation. And, you know, whenever I travel, you know, internationally, I end up encountering, you know, new kinds of fermented foods that I haven't tried before. A year and a half ago, I got invited to Indonesia, and you know, I learned about lots of different foods that I didn't know about. You know, how, you know, cultures being used in ways that I had never heard about, and so, you know, that's incredibly exciting. And you know, I really I mean, at this point, you know, because people are always imagining that I have a comprehensive knowledge of fermentation, I mean, I feel really clear that it would just be impossible for any human being to sort of like, or any one human being to just like, you know, contain the, you know, infinite, you know, variation of fermentation practices that exist around the world. So I find that, you know, continually exciting. And then the other thing is, because I do all of this teaching, you know, a lot of times people will, you know, show up at my workshops, you know, wanting to share things that they've fermented. So I'm always getting to see these, like, you know, clever, you know, flavor and seasoning variations, you know, just that people who come to the workshops have thought of. So, you know, that's always a lot of fun. You know, I love to cook. You know, I'm pretty much like a creature of habit. When I find a way that I like to do things, I'll often just do it the same way. And I haven't really been wildly experimental in my flavoring of sauerkrauts. But, like, you know, I'm thinking of this woman, Sasha, who showed up at a workshop maybe a year ago, and it had vanilla beans in the sauerkraut. And I never would have thought of that. It seemed so weird, but it was so delicious. So I feel like, you know, I'm continually being stimulated by new ideas, whether it's like traditions I've never heard about or just, you know, people's creative applications of, you know, old traditions to new kinds of ingredients.
That was Sander Katz talking about fermentation. To hear Sander Katz' story about tempeh from the Underground Airwaves series, you can visit the Edible Portland website, or you can go to the Food Show Facebook page, where you'll find more links to some of the things that we talked about here on the show.
Next, we're going to have a live interview with Barry Lynn. Barry Lynn is a former advertising executive who took a client to a slow food fundraiser when she tasted cheese, met the cheesemakers, and her mission to share a love of cheese was born. Since then, she's been educating people about cheese by writing, teaching workshops, hosting cheese parties and events, and producing a web video series called Cheese Rules. She's especially interested in pairing cheeses with other foods and beverages for an enhanced experience. Barry Lynn, welcome to the Food Show.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here right before the holidays, sharing some information on cheese.
Great. Thanks, Barry Lynn. This is Chris, by the way, and I'm here with Peter.
Hello, Chris and Peter.
So what is it about cheese that drew you to turning it into a profession when you already had a career going?
Well, it was really love. I, as you said, I took a client, an advertising client, to a fundraiser for Slow Food. And in my lifestyle, I'd always been a proponent of the farmers markets and the small family producers, and was a really long, long time passionate member of Slow Food internationally and then also nationally. And I went to this cheese tasting, and my whole world shifted. I don't know. Have either of you ever fallen in love at first sight?
I think it's happened. I mean, with a person maybe, but with a thing. But it doesn't. I don't know if it's ever happened that severely that I was like, I have to change everything.
Yeah, this was severe. I mean, Cupid's arrow really just flew at me. And my world shifted, and I just in my head said, this is where I want to be. I want to be helping these small cheesemakers and small family farmers really, you know, reach a wider audience. And I was a launch specialist in advertising, launching noted brands, so that's the first thing I thought of. And I never thought it would be a job or anything, career. I really just approached it as a manic hobby. And, you know, I bought all the books and took all the classes and traveled hiking up mountains in Italy to a small cheesemaker who was a former rock star, and, you know, just sort of getting really into it. I named myself the Cheese Impresario, kind of as a lark. Impresario is a person really who just loves the opera so much. They just want it to happen, and they don't sing the opera. But they really, you know, turn people onto it and get excitement around it. And kind of that's the why I named myself the Cheese Impresario, because I don't sell cheese. I don't have a cheese shop. I really educate people and turn them on so they can have more pleasure with it.
Yeah. Do you think that love of cheese, well, it sounds like it happened spontaneously for you. You sort of fell in love at first sight. But Is there anything that you can do to get to help somebody else discover their same love and passion for cheese?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it happened really with one cheese. I mean, that's what kind of shifted. And, you know, now certainly I know a lot more. It's a small cheese company, very small. There's one person there. It's called Uplands Cheese Company, and it's a cow's milk cheese out of Wisconsin. And it is called Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And it's a kind of a mountain-style cheese with a bit of a, you know, it's an aged cheese. It's got a lot of nutty characteristics, but I tasted that cheese, and all the, like, it was like a rainbow of flavors came at me. And I know, but some years later, this cheese has become world famous, even though it's very, very small. It's won Best Cheese 3 years at the American Cheese Society conference and competition over thousands of cheeses. So that's the cheese that kind of started it all for me. And, you know, I didn't know what to do with this. I mean, here I was in love, and I was, you know, printed up cards as the cheese impresario, and I do cheese tastings for my friends. And
okay, it looks like we've lost
some technical
Barry Lynn, but we're going to kind of bring her back here in a second. So, yeah, so I guess we'll continue our own little conversation about cheese.
You know, I actually went to a cheese station tasting with wine the other day, last Wednesday. I was down at the Brasserie. Got to see my friend Ben Turner playing piano, just rapping whenever I can. Sure. I know you're over there at OPB, man. Hearts out. But yeah, no, actually, cheese and wine go really well together. Like, actually, I had like cheese and wine.
Mm-hmm.
You ever have a friend that you say, like, you want some cheese with that wine?
Right, yeah, that joke, there is truth with it. Yeah, and I know when we get Barry Lynn back on that she's going to want to talk to us a little bit about pairings, and especially as it is nearing the holiday season. I don't know, I feel like this time of year it's easy to go on the food show to do holiday-related topics, mm-hmm. but this will be a good one, kind of a light way to end the segment. I know I've recently taken to... If I want to have an experience, I'll get three cheeses,
mm-hmm.
and it's like I feel like that amount is the perfect amount to try three new cheeses and then get to really enjoy them.
Yeah, I noticed like after you get four or more, it's kind of like they all start tasting, you know, cheesy,
mm-hmm.
but you can really tell when it's three. It's sort of like maybe less like Goldilocks, maybe it's like dark medium brown. Do you like light cheeses or dark cheeses more?
I don't know if I've looked at it that way. I feel like I always look at stinky cheese and
mm-hmm.
and not stinky cheese. I guess I'm drawn to more darker cheese. I don't know. I say that and then I'm immediately like I want to eat all cheeses all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Looks like we're still having a little bit of trouble getting Barry Lynn back on. Okay. So I don't know if we want to talk a little bit more about the raw milk with the USDA while we're waiting to get her back.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying, we were talking earlier,
yeah.
that you know, anecdotally, it seems to me like my experience with raw milk has been generally positive, that it's been a good thing. If you know where the milk is coming from and you kind of can see that process and can make sure that it stays clean and sterile, that it can be something that's very much healthy and that you don't run into illness. So,
yeah, if you're not milking a sick cow, you probably won't get a bunch of bacteria in your milk.
Sure. It seems like in these larger operations, I guess the problem that USDA has is that with pasteurization, you can milk all cows. And it's pretty amazing that a number of the cows that you're milking can be sick and you can still collect that milk because you're pasteurizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it's a large operation and you're collecting all that milk, you got to know exactly how, you know, exactly what the conditions of the cows are, how, if they're well or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that, and this is, I think, a lot of like farm bills that come through, is that there are operations that are smaller that can kind of cater to a smaller market, and that they, as a result, have more control over their processes. And the problem with having this one sort of like study, this one finding that's for all raw milk, is that it doesn't take into account these smaller operators.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
great. So it sounds like we have Barry Lynn back on the phone. So are you there?
I am. I don't even know where I was talking away, and I said, boy, these guys are awfully quiet.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I want to leave enough time for you to talk about pairings, because I think that's really kind of what's exciting at this time. But I also, just real quick, I know this isn't a sports show, but I watched the video of you with Sean Phillips, who's a linebacker for the Denver Broncos, and I found it so charming. So I just wanted to kind of tell us how the web series came together, and then how you got connected to him.
Yeah, well, Sean, I met a friend of his at a very small party, and I brought a little cheese plate. And she said, oh, you've got to meet my friend Sean Phillips. He's a NFL player, but he actually loves cheese. He keeps a cheese diary. And he did his degree from Purdue in hotel and restaurant management, and did his paper, major paper, to graduate on his favorite food, cheese. So we got together and just really just get along. I mean, we are like Mutt and Jeff. It's really funny. And we love each other, and then did a bunch of stuff together. And then when I was doing my series, I asked him if he would fly to Seattle to shoot a couple of shows with me. And he came up, and, you know, we rocked out doing my famous grilled cheese sandwich with the Wisconsin blue cheese and pairing it with a Manhattan. So, you know, it's the cheese highway really takes us along so many ways. I mean, so many different people I've met has just been a blast, and he's one of them.
Definitely. The video I watched was Chardonnay and Gruyere.
Chris was talking about this a second ago, but as the holidays are coming up, people want to prepare platters and food, like hors d'oeuvres to impress their friends. Can you tell us a couple of your favorite cheese pairings?
Yes, I certainly can. Well, you can't go wrong with cheddar, because cheddar works with so many different wines, beer, and cocktails and spirits. And there's the expensive cheddars that are 8 and 10 years old, and then there's just the good old, you know, delicious cheddars. And I serve them with everything from bourbon to brandy. There's a great cocktail I made up, the apple brandy cocktail, that's got brandy and apple brandy and vermouth, and just shake it up and put it in a glass and a little piece of apple, and it's just fabulous with Gouda and Parmesan and cheddar and Swiss and Emmentaler and all of that. And I'm pretty famous at the holidays because I love the combination of libations and cheese. And I created a kind of unusual mac and cheese with a Gouda from my friend Marika. She's a farmstead operation, again in Wisconsin. She does a fenugreek Gouda with fenugreek seeds. It's a seed from Holland they use to sweeten curries. And so it gives you that maple syrupy flavor. Then I put some cheddar in it, grate those two up, make the mac and cheese, but take just about 3/4 of the milk, and the rest of it, I make a dark rum Manhattan cocktail, put that in, make my own breadcrumbs with rum butter, and people go crazy over it.
Wow, that sounds incredible.
Yeah.
I wonder for the folks who are who are more into brevity as far as their preparations, What would you say for a really good cheese and wine combination?
Well, you know, I like concept. You know, it makes it a lot easier. And so one idea, because there's so much of the choice here in our country now, is an Italian-style platter. You can start with a fresh mozzarella, then go to a Parmesan, then go, you know, to something blue. There's a lot of choices out there in all different specialty stores as well as the supermarkets. and then pair it with a variety of Italian-style wine. There's so much coming out of California now. They call it Calitals, where you can get the Pinot Grigio and the Sangioveses and, you know, wines that are affordable but fantastic paired with the cheeses.
Mm-hmm. So we just have about one more minute. And this is a kind of a hard thing to put on you, but tell me, if you had to choose one cheese right now, what would that be?
Oh, this is a bad answer, but it's true. You know, I am a curious character, and I'm always in search of that brand new cheese, you know, from these creative cheesemakers. And so I would say it's the one I haven't had yet.
Of course. Then how about the follow-up? What's the, like, the most recent cheese that you had that just sort of, you know, blew your mind?
Oh, I just had a cheese. It's called Chai Bella Vitano. It's a unique cheese. The Sartori family, fourth generation, makes it. So they make a cheese that's not a Parmesan, not a cheddar, it's cow's milk. And then it's medium, you know, medium hard, and then they rub it with chai spices. It's just unbelievable.
Oh,
that's my favorite new cheese.
That sounds amazing. Barry Lynn, I would love to come to a party that you put on.
We can figure that out and rock out together.
That would be awesome. That would be great. Barry Lynn, thank you so much for joining us here on The Food Show.
Okay, happy holidays, everyone. Enjoy cheese.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Bye.
All right, well, that's it for the December edition of The Food Show. I want to thank our guests, June Colony, Sandor Katz, and Barry Lynn. A huge thanks to our board operator, Tammy. The Food Show airs the third Wednesday of the month, and we'll be back in the new year on January 15th at the same time. Stay tuned to KBOO. Up next is 2 hours of jazz. I'm Peter Schoaf.
And I'm Chris Siegel.
Thanks for listening to The Food Show.
Some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good. 'Cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry. Trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat. You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. 'Cause people need food in their belly. Need some for the guy in their throat, and need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for Wednesday, December 18th. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, it was announced on December 9th that over 120,000 signatures supporting marriage equality for all couples has been secured by Oregon United for Marriage. This is enough signatures to place the measure on next year's ballot, but the qualification process must still be completed. The organization will also continue to collect additional signatures to make certain they have enough to qualify while educating voters about why the initiative is important.
Because of two recent high school suicides, Corvallis High School conducted an informational forum for educators Monday, followed by a community talk for parents that evening. Since organizing the forum, Corvallis suffered one suicide, a 2011 graduate. Dr. John Garlinghouse, a Eugene-based therapist, advised the audience that talking about suicide does not cause, but helps eliminate them by getting the related myths and concerns out of the shadows. Suicide rates shoot up at age 17 and through young adulthood because of the number of life changes faced and because the young person may have been considering it for some time. The best thing parents and teachers can do is reach out, establish rapport, and get professional help if the youth appears vulnerable.
In national news, GlaxoSmithKline, the sixth largest drug maker in the world, has announced it will cease paying doctors to promote its drugs and stop tying sales representatives' compensation to the number of prescriptions written. While many of the company's competitors have shown no sign of stopping using doctors for promotions, GlaxoSmithKline has steadily reduced this practice over the last several years. While close ties with doctors can lead to more effective medications, it can also lead to doctors downplaying drug side effects and poor research outcomes. By the end of this year, all drug companies operating in the United States will have to reveal the extent of their use of doctors to promote their products under the health care reform law passed last year.
A district judge appointed by George Bush has ruled that the NSA's domestic surveillance practice may violate Fourth Amendment privacy rights. Earlier in his career, Judge Richard J. Leon helped create legal justifications for Republican lawbreaking and helped intimidate Iran-Contra-related witnesses seeking to expose GOP wrongdoing. He won Bush's gratitude by representing Bush family interests and gaining a reputation as a partisan bully who made sure politically charged investigations reached a desired outcome, whatever the facts. Leon was there at the beginning of George W. Bush's